Okay, we're beginning here with the Mishnah on Chav Dalet Amud Aleph. What's important to know for this Mishnah is the psukim that are found by the Yabam, which is Ki yeshvu achim yachdav umeit achad mehem ubein en lo lo tiyesh demeit achutz alish zar. Brothers that live together, one of them passes away, he doesn't have children, the wife cannot be to a third party. Yivama yavo alea ulekacha lo liyishav yivma. So the Yabam will be miyabim this woman and take her as a wife. Then the next pasuk, the pashtura pasuk, which I'll read to you, and then the Gemara is going to go and read darshan this entire pasuk, which is vaya bechor asher teleid. And it seemingly, this is what the pasuk means, the first child that is born from this levirate marriage, from this yabam and yivama, yakum hashem achiv amet, will take on the name of his deceased brother. And his name will not be wiped out from Klal Yisrael. So if you read the simple pshat in the pasuk, is that this child will stand instead of the deceased brother, the child born of this marriage of the Abam and the Yavama. The Ramban extensively speaks about this by Tamar and Yehuda when he speaks about Yibum. He speaks in Kabbalistic terms about the idea that the Nefesh, the neshama of the deceased brother, is then mitgalgel and comes in this child, and this child is the closest representative, and brothers in both in terms of blood link and neshamot are closest in similarity, and therefore the brother doing the yibum makes it that the child will be most domeh to the deceased brother. And the Ramban has an extensive piece about this part of yibum. But all that being said, the Gemara says that's not what the pasuk means, and that's what this Mishnah says. Mitzvah begadol yiyabim. The mitzvah is with the, we'll call it the eldest, to perform yibum. Bim kadana kadan zacha. If the katan jumps the gun and does it before the elder brother, then what's done is done. I mean, it's not to the exclusion of the katan. It just means that there's priority or precedence given to the gadol, but if the katan runs with it, he will be zoche. Teravanan. Vayaha bechor, mikan shemitzvah begadol liyabim. So here, the Gemara clearly takes it out of context and says, vayaha bechor, ayah bechor seems to be the first child that's born. All of a sudden here, the Gemara says, vayaha bechor refers to the miyabim and not to the product of the yabim and yivama. So the bechor, mikan shemitzvah begadol liyabim. Asher teleid, prat la'ailonit she'eno yoledet. So Asher Teleid comes to exclude an Ailunit who doesn't have the ability to give birth, therefore there's no mitzvah of Yibum in that scenario. Yokum Hashem Achiv Lenachala, Ata Umer Lenachala, Oenu Elo Lishem. So here is the pivot point where the Gemara takes the Pasuk out of context, and from this is basically the fallout of the rest of the Pasuk. It says here that Yokum Hashem Achiv Ayamet. Who's that referring to? The Pashtura Pasuk, because it's referring to the child that is born, will replace the name of the deceased brother. On the other hand, the Gemara is saying that Hashem Achiv L'Nachala, the Miyabim, comes and replaces his brother in terms of inheritance. He basically takes over that brother's position within the Nachala. Or, do we say no, it's to name the baby. Yosef, Koronoto Yosef. If the deceased brother was Yosef, the child born of this marriage would be called Yosef. Yochanan, Korimoto Yochanan. If his brother's name was Yochanan, they called the child that was born Yochanan. Nemar kan yakum al shem achiv. Benemar lehalan, and it says, in Breshit, Hashem achehem yikar'u ben nachalatam. Remainder of their brothers, they will be called ben nachalatam, meaning that anybody born after this point in time will then be subsumed under their brothers. Ma shame ha'amur lahalan nachala. Just like over there in Breshit, when it uses the term shame, name, it doesn't mean their names literally, but it means that they are under or subsumed under their brothers' names in the nachala. It's by the Ephraim and Menashe. Any children born after that point in time will be included under part of Ephraim and Menashe and not have their own independent shevet. Af shame ha'amur kan lenachala. So too over here, the shame that is written here is the Nachala. Velo yimachesh shemo. His name will not be wiped out. Prat the saris shishmo machui. That comes to exclude a saris whose name is already machui. It will not happen. So now, if we take a step back now The Gemara only has a proof to one part of the statement here, which is Yakum Hashem Achiv. In terms of Yakum Hashem Achiv, the simple pshat is that you will name the baby after the deceased brother. The Gemara comes along and says, well, now that I have a Gzeirah Shavah, the Gzeirah Shavah tells me that it's not speaking about the name of the baby, but it's speaking about the Nachala, that the Yabam will stand in place of the deceased brother for Nachala. And then Rava's statement, Omer Rava, Afagav D'B'chol HaTorah Kula, Ein Mikra Yotzei Midei Pshuto. In general, when we have a drush on a pasuk, there's the drash, and there's the pshat. So the pasuk has a level of pshat, which we will not ignore, but it also has the drash that sits on top of it. So they both are true. Hocha ata gzereshava afikte mipashte legamre. Over here, when the gzereshava comes, it takes the pasuk completely out of context, and therefore the pasuk no longer has pashup shat to it. So based on Rava, basically what you have a conclusion here is that the pasuk that says Yakum Hashem Achiv means that he will replace his brother in the Nachala, and that not that you have to name the child after the deceased brother. There is no pshat like that in the pasuk. The pshat is gone b'gamrei. So without the Gzeirah Shavah, we would have thought it might have been talking about naming. But once we have the Gzeirah Shavah, Rava says that no longer remains at all. And the only thing that remains is Nachala, that he replaces him for Nachala. Now, once I've done that, I don't have to read the pasuk like that. I can't read the pasuk like that. I have to change the context or the subject of the pasuk. Because before, when I said Asher Yakum Hashem Achiv HaMeit, then the subject of that piece of the pasuk was the child that was born. And that means that the whole pasuk was talking about the child that was born. But now that I've changed the subject of the sentence to Yakum Hashem Achiv is the Abam, I have to go back and read the whole pasuk as being the Yabam. And that's how we get to the conclusions that we have. By taking that piece out of context, then we level out the pasuk and I read the whole pasuk that way, which is now, Vaya b'chor asher teled. So now, the b'chor asher teled, b'chor, now is the subject of the b'chor is not the child that's born, but the Yabam. And that's how the Mishnah got, what is the b'chor here? The eldest child. Asher teled. Asher teled is referring to the Yabam, or here it'll be referring to the Yivama, that only if she can give birth will it be meaningful. Yakum Hashem Achiv is the Yabam. Yakum Hashem Achiv HaMeit, he'll replace him in the Nachla. Velo Yimecheh Shemo Mi Yisrael is talking about the deceased brother. The deceased brother, Lo Yimecheh Shemo Mi Yisrael, because if he was a Saris, then Shemo Machui, and you don't have to do anything. So we took the pasuk, which otherwise was talking about the child that would have been born from the Yabam and Yivama. We took that from that level, and we jumped it up a level. That means that all the subjects of this pasuk now become the level of the brothers, the Miyabein, the brother that deceased, and the Yivama. And that's how we read Darshan the pasuk, because of that one piece that we have Gzeir Shava about. But Rava makes that statement, which says that he has a Misora, as Rashi says, otherwise there's no reason to do this. Without the Misora, you would have assumed that the Gzeirah Shavah applies, but so does the Pashup Shad of the Pasuk. Rava has a Misora that Pashup Shad of the Pasuk no longer is meaningful. And being no longer meaningful, I reinterpret the whole Pasuk, and I don't interpret it about the child at all. And based on that, there's no obligation to name the child after the deceased brother. That doesn't exist the way that Rava is explaining it. And that's how we got to all the drashot that we had before. Vaya Bechor. Mikan shemitzvah begadol yabeim asher teled prat nai lonit sheino yoledet kum Hashem Achiv is lanachala, and the last part of the pasuk, which is lo yemachesh shmo miYisrael prat lisaris. Now with regards to saris, you have to be careful. Over here, the mefarshim call it a saris chama, which is someone who was born maybe congenitally had this problem, and therefore it's considered to be shmo machui, because there's no way he could have had children at all for a saris adam. Or for something that developed, which seemingly developed after the marriage, he was at some point able to reproduce. And therefore he may not be precluded, because we saw earlier on in the Masechta, we discussed this issue, and over there, the Gemara talked about the fact that if a Saris is Boel the Yivama, then it works out. Or Psua Daka is Boel the Yivama, then the Yibum takes hold. Even though there's an Isur Lav there, the Yibum takes hold. But why does it take hold? If Shmo Machoy, there is no Yibum over there. The answer has to be, and I mentioned that over there, is that with regards to those individuals, they were ra'ui, leleid, when they got married, and only later on did it develop that they had this issue, and therefore it's not shmo machui, because there was a point in time where he could have reproduced. So that's why over here you have to say it's talking about a Sris Chama, someone who's congenitally that way, because they had no chance of having children ever, and therefore Shmo Machui, and there is no Yibum whatsoever here. Now the Gemara says, Ilav Gzereshava, had it not been for the Gzereshava, you are telling me that what I would have thought is, the Pasuk that says Yakum Hashem Achiv Ameit means that you will name it after the child. Hava Amina, Shem, Shem Mamash. When it says the Shem here, it literally means to name it. Leman Kamizayir Rachmona. Who is the Torah telling you must name the child this? The Yabam. If it's talking to the Yabam, it should say Yakum Hashem Achicha. It should talk in the second person. If you're talking to the Yabam himself, it should say, you should name the child after your brother. Because you're speaking directly to the Yabam, and the brother is his brother, it should be written in the second person. The Pasuk says, Yakum Hashem Achiv, which is written in the third person. Why isn't it written in the second person? Yakum Hashem Achicha Mibayle. Either Beit Dina, if the command is the Beit Din, then it should be Yakum Hashem Achi Aviv Mibayle. Then, if they're speaking to the Beit Din, vis-a-vis the child, the Beit Din, it should say to him, well, you should name it after your father's brother, meaning after the uncle who is deceased. That's how it should term it. It shouldn't say Achiv, which is Ach Shelo. It should say Achi Aviv, because they're speaking about the child, they're commanding Beit Din, you should name this child after the father's brother. And that's not the way it's written. The Beit Din. Maybe this is what the Torah is saying to Beit Din. So the Gemara says, maybe this is the way we should interpret what's being said to Beit Din. Amru le'le yabam, yakum Hashem achiv. That they are instructed, not about the child, but they're instructed about the yabam. And they should say to the yabam that the child should be named after achiv, after ach shelo. So that's the answer in the end. The pasuk is commanding Beit Din to instruct the yabam that he must name the child after the yabam's brother. So that's the way we're going to read the pasuk, because of the fact that it's using achiv in the third person. So it's obviously not speaking directly to the yabam, but it's speaking to Beit Din. But it's speaking to Beit Din not about the child, but about the yabam himself, what he must do. Ela atai gzeira shava afikte legamre. So therefore, the gzeira shava comes along and takes it totally out of context and says there's nothing to do with naming. Hashta damart kra begadol ktiv. So now, once you say that the pasuk is talking about the gadol, Ema b'chor liyabem, pashut lo liyabem. All right, now we're going to take it the way that you want, which is the gzeira shava now moves up the discussion of the pasuk to the yabam and not the child that is born. Then it says vayah b'chor. So why don't we say that a b'chor performs yibum? Anyone who's not a b'chor will not perform yibum, meaning that a pashut, anyone who's not a b'chor will not perform yibum, because the pasuk says vayah b'chor. So b'chor should perform yibum. So the Gemara says, "Im kein eshet achiv shelo yabalomo demiut rachmana lomali." Why do you need the miut of a brother who is not around at the time that this brother was married? That can never happen. By definition, if the bechor is around, then every other child is younger than the bechor. If every other child is younger than the bechor, there's no way there's ever a case of eshet achiv shelo yabalomo. The fact that the Torah tells you ki yeshvu achim yachdav comes to exclude eshet achiv shelo yabalomo implies that there has to be a younger brother that could possibly be born and perform Yibum over here. Otherwise, there's no meaning to that exclusion. So, Parich Ravacha Ve'ema Le'me'ute Bukhra De'ima. So he says, wait, maybe it's coming to exclude a Bukhur from the mother. Meaning that, in the case here, what is Eshet Achiv Shelo Yabolomo? That's a case where it's a Bukhur from the mother. And we'll say, well, if it's Eshet Achiv Shelo Yabolomo, that knocks out Bukhur from the mother. So, Bukhur from the father is the one who performs Yibum. Why do I need Eshet Achiv Shelo Yabolomo? Because maybe there's a case where the Bechor La'im will still be Shelo Haya Be'olomo. Gemara says, Ha'olo Matzit Amart. You can't say this. De Yibum Be'Nachla Talo Rachmono. Because Yibum has to do with Nachala, as we just saw before, that it's connected to Nachala. Nachala Min Av Velo Min A'im. When it comes to Nachala, Nachala goes through the father's family and not the mother's family. Or, basically, in terms of familial relationships, the only family that counts is the father's family. So if you're performing Yibum, the father's family counts. Whatever is the Bechor. Bechor min ha'av is what matters, not Bechor min ha'im. And therefore, that can't be what the Pasuk is addressing. So now the Gemara says, Ve'ema ki'ika Bechor titkayim mitzvat Yibum. Ki'leka Bechor lo titkayim mitzvat Yibum. So let us suggest now, Vaya Bechor indicates that if the Bechor is alive, then either the Bechor or one of the other brothers can perform Yibum. The Bechor is the Me'afsher that Yibum be performed. Doesn't mean it has to be him, but it can be any of the brothers. But if there is no Bechor, then the mitzvah of Yibum will not apply. Not to him and not to anyone else. Amakra, the Pasuk says, Umeit Echad Mehem. One of the brothers died. So it says here, Kishvu Yachim Yachdav, Umeit Echad Mehem. One of the brothers dies. Milo Askinan, Demit Bechor. Let us assume, at minimum, Kishvu Yachim Yachdav means there are two brothers. So then the Pasuk says, there are two brothers, and one of them died. Well, the Pasuk doesn't specify which one of them died. It could be, Milo Askinan, Demit Bechor, that the older one died, and it's telling the younger one to perform Yibum. Katan, that the Katan will perform the Yibum. Mar says, no. Who says that? Maybe the Pasuk is, Vema Demit Katan. Why don't you suggest the other way around, that it has to be that younger brother passes away. That the Torah is talking about, Kiyeshvu Yachim Yachdav, two brothers, only one that could have died, that this will apply to is if the younger one passes away. The older one passes away, there'll be no Yibum. Mar says, Hamiyit Rachmana, Ishid Achiv, Shaloya Bolomol. Wait a minute. The Torah already excluded a case of Ish Rechid Shalei Obalomol. Now, if that's the case, you're never going to have a case of Ish Rechid Shalei Obalomol because you're suggesting now that the Bechor always has to be there. If the Bechor has to be there, then Ish Rechid Shalei Obalomol is never going to be relevant in a case where you have two brothers because it's the older brother and the younger brother. And you're telling me it's the younger brother that passed away, the younger brother passed away, there's no Ish Rechid Shalei Obalomol. It says, okay, Ve'ema ki laka Bechor Kadam Katan Vizakha. Okay, let me say it this way. When there's no Bechor, the Katan has the right to jump in and do what he has to do. Ve'ika Bechor, Kadam Katan, Lozaka. That in the face of Bechor, the Katan doesn't have a right to be Miyabim. I mean, the obligation sits with the Bechor. He has precedence, but not only precedence, he has exclusive rights to Yibum, unless he passes up on it. But let's assume he has exclusive rights. And therefore, if the Katan jumps the gun, it won't take effect. Correct. He has the right of first refusal. And he can make the decision to go ahead and perform Yibum. If the Katan jumps the gun, it doesn't work because the Bechor has that right. Whereas, if there's no Bechor, then if the Katan jumps the gun. So Amakra, ki Yeshua Achim Yachdav, Huksha Yeshivat Achim Zelaze. That all the brothers are Mukash Echad Hasheni, meaning they are considered to be level. Veima ki Ika Bechor Lahader Agadol, ki Laka Bechor in Chozim Etzel Gadol. Okay, so the Gemara is acquiesced now that the Bechor is not a pivotal decision here in terms of the Yibum. You don't need a Bechor to perform Yibum, number one. Number two is the Bechor doesn't have any more right than the other brothers to perform Yibum. The mitzvah is for him to do it, but if someone else jumps the gun, they get the Yivama, and you can't, the Bechor cannot block that. The only thing that we have so far is that the Bechor has precedence. Now the Gemara says, okay, Ika Bechor La'adir Agadol. So then when the Bechor is around, we'll say that the Bechor has precedence. He has a mitzvah to do it first. But without a Bechor, then there's no precedence, meaning that it's a free-for-all. Ki laka Bechor in chozrim etzel gadol. So that's a question now, which is there something unique about a Bechor that he gets precedence over the other brothers? Or we tell him to do it, it's a mitzvah for him to do it. But outside of that, it's not. Or does it have to do with age? Meaning that the oldest brother has the right. So lama tani abayik shisha. But if that's the case, why do we have this braita brought by Abayi Kshisha? Mitzvah bigadol liyabim. The mitzvah is for the gadol to perform yibum. Lo ratza hochim itzel achiv hakatan. If not, we go to his younger brother. Now over here, there's some question about the girsa. If you look in Tosafot, Tosafot had a different girsa here. He had a girsa that included katan mimenu. Then you go to the next youngest. And then you go down the line. The way that Tosafot writes it is that you have the oldest brother, and then you go to the next down, and then you go down, 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 until you get to the youngest. Then, lo ratza chozrim etzel gadol. If they don't want it, then you go back to the gadol, and tell them you have to act at that point in time. There are others who suggest that only you have to go to the gadol, and then the katan, and then you go back to the gadol. Whether you have to go through the whole line or not is not clear. Our Gemara over here does not have a girsa that implies that they go through the entire line of brothers. Just they go to the oldest and the next, and then it comes back again to the gadol. Tosfot says that he thinks it should be that they go to the ketanim mimenu, each one that's younger, and then they come back to the gadol. So now the Gemara says, Abayi Kshisha uses the term gadol and not bechor. And therefore it seems like he's talking about the eldest, not necessarily the bechor. So if you're telling me that it's only in the case of bechor where we give precedence, or we say it's a mitzvah, the Bechor, then why is he using the word Gadol? That's what the Gemara wants to know now. In a case where a Bechor dies, or there is no Bechor, that's another possibility, is there a mitzvah la Gadol? Or is this only when there's a Bechor, is there a mitzvah la Bechor? That's exactly what the Gemara is trying to clarify now. How extensive is this? Is this simply about age? Or is this about the special standing of a Bechor? So the Gemara said, maybe that's what it is. It's the special standing of the Bechor. The Gemara says, well, if you say that, then how do I explain this statement of a Bayik Shisha? Because in a Bayik Shisha, it makes it sound like we're talking about a Gadol and not about Bechor. The fact that he uses the term Gadol seems to say it has to do with age. It has to do with the age of the individual, nothing to do with the status as a Bechor. So age is what's goreim. So the Gemara says, Ke Bechor. Ma Bechor, Bechorato Garmalo. Av Gadol, Gedulato Garmalo. So just like by the Bechor, what is the cause for the fact that he has to be the one to do it first? Is Bechorato. Now Bechorato over here, it's nothing unique about the Bechor. It's the fact that he is the oldest. So just like by the Bechor, the fact that he is the oldest is what causes him here to do the Yibum, so too by the Gadol, the oldest brother, it'll be the same thing. The oldest brother will be obligated in order to deal with this Yivama. He has the first right of refusal, and then after that, we'll go down the line. And if nobody acts, he will have to make a decision, either to perform Yibum or Chalitza. He will be the final stop here to figure out what we're going to do with this woman if nobody else is willing to act. Alright. Ve'ema ki miyabim b'chor l'shkol nachala. So let us say the way the pasuk's written is, v'aya b'chor, and then yakum Hashem achiv. So if the b'chor performs it, then he'll get the nachala of the deceased brother. Ki miyabim pashut, if anybody else does it, lo l'shkol nachala, because they're not in the pasuk. Amakra, yakum Hashem achiv. Harekam. The pasuk says, what is the reason for getting the nachala? Because he's Yakum Hashem Achiv. He took over his brother's place. And this person did that. Once he takes over the brother's place, it's not governed by Vaya Bechor, it's governed by Yakum Hashem Achiv. The Kima is what generates the Nachala. And whoever is Kam, whoever fills in the shoes of the brother, they're the one that get the Nachala. Vela Bechor Dekari Yerachmano. So then why does the Pasuk call it Vaya Bechor and then Yakum Hashem Achiv? What does Bechor teach you? Lamai Hilchata, the Griuta. It actually turns out to be a negative piece. Although there are positive sides to it, but here the Gemara focuses on this negative piece of the Bechor, which is, Ma Bechor inu notel b'ra'ui kemukzak, havhai inu notel b'ra'ui kemukzak. Just like a Bechor does not take incoming, but only what is there, so too, the Yabam only takes what's there and not what's incoming. So let's just talk about the halacha with regards to a Bechor. A Bechor gets a double portion in the father's possessions. When the father passes away, they basically, if there are, say, two children here, there's a Bechor and a child besides him, then they will take the father's possessions, divide it into three. Two of those portions will go to the Bechor, one portion will go to the Pashut. Now, it happens to be that they have a grandfather who's still alive. Their father passed away, but their grandfather is still alive. When their grandfather passes away, that Nachala would have passed to their father, and then eventually will get to them. That is, at this moment in time, it's not part of their father's Yerusha. That is what's called Ra'ui. It will in the future be a part of their father's Yerusha. As far as the Bechor is concerned, the Bechor only gets double portion in what is Mukhzak, in what is currently there, what's currently available and ready for inheritance. On the day of the death of their father, whatever is there, that's what he gets. But in the future, things that will come to them because of their father, the Yerusha comes to them through their father, there he does not get the double portion because that's called Ra'ui. That is something that will happen. It isn't something that is present right now. So that's what's called, his Bechor only gets Mukzak, he does not get Ra'ui. We're saying the same thing over here with regards to the brother. The brother who steps into his brother's shoes, then he gets B'Mukzak and he doesn't get B'Ra'ui. I'll explain it to you according to Rashi. And then the Rabbeinu Chananel and most of the other Rishonim disagree with Rashi, and most of them bring down the halacha, not like Rashi. Rashi says over here that so too, Af Yabam notel pishnayim b'nichsei aviv. So too, the Yabam takes two portions. Just like a Bechor would take two portions, so too this Yabam takes two portions in the father's possession. Chalko v'chalko achiv shemeit. But he does not take in ro'oi mokzak, he does not take in that which will come in the future. So when the father passes away, again, if there is this Yabam and another brother, they'll divide the father's possessions into three, the Abam will get two portions, and the other brother will get only one portion. But things that come in the future, that will not matter. But most of Yishraim disagree with Rashi. Rashi basically sets up the Yabam exactly like a Bechor, which is about when the father passes away. How does the Nachala pass at that point in time? Just like it passes for a Bechor, only what's in the father's possession at that time, so too the Yabam only gets what's in the father's possession at a time in that division. The Rabbeinu Kanan and the other Rishonim learn that actually it has to do with when the father passes away. If the father predeceases the brother, then we have a situation in which the Abam will take over the estate of the deceased brother. And that's how it'll work. He'll be the first to take over, and he'll take over the estate of his brother. That already been given, because that's muhzak. That's already given, and so therefore he takes it over. That's how he gets his double portion. He gets his portion, which he already inherited from his father, plus he'll get the portion of his brother, which was already inherited from his father. But if the brother predeceases the father, that's called ra'ui, because they have yet to inherit their father. And since they have yet to inherit their father, when their father passes away, he will not get that possession. They will not get that piece that's coming from their father. Two remaining brothers will just split the father's estate in half. He will not get an extra portion. The other Rishonim bring proofs. It's not from our Gemara, from other places, what the meaning of Mugzak is. And over here, the meaning of Mugzak was basically what they're saying is it has to be here now. It has to be a Nachala already. It has to be a Yerusha already. If it's the father in the future, that's Ra'oi. That's not Mugzak. And just like by the Bechor, that's not called Mugzak. Therefore, we say that he only gets the portion of his brother that already is with his brother. He's not going to get the future portion that will come from the father. That's the way the other Rishonim learn. Rashi learns it that it's the same way like a Bechor. At the time of the death of their father, the Bechor would get a double portion because that's the trigger, is the death of the father. So Tovia, the death of the father is the trigger, and therefore he'll get his portion plus the Yabam's, the deceased brother's portion from the father. That's the end of the sugya. Here, again, they took the pasuk out of context, and therefore we come up with these interesting halachot. Tosfot does point out that there is a benefit to this also, which is that when he inherits his brother, it becomes a Yerusha, and it's not a Lekicha, which makes a difference for the Ovel. When it comes to the Ovel, does he have to return the property? If it was simply that he got, as if he bought it from his brother, then in the Ovel he'd have to return it to his brother and have to redivide it again each time. Whereas if it's considered a Yerusha, then he doesn't have to give it back in the Ovel. So Tosafot says there is a positive aspect to this, not just a negative aspect of it. Although Tosafot in Bechorot says maybe it's not so positive, because not everybody agrees with that, that this is considered to be a Nachla, and that considered to be a Lekicha. But leaving that aside, there is some other aspects to it of this being a Yerusha and not being a Lekicha. Right, so that's the end of this topic about the precedence given to the oldest brother. The oldest brother is asked to do it first. We ask in order of age to do it, to perform the Yibum. It's partly an achrayut issue, which is that the oldest should take responsibility, and therefore we look at the oldest to take responsibility. The other thing is that we prefer Yibum over Chalitza. Therefore, if the oldest refuses to act, then we go to the next brother and check if any one of them wants to do Yibum. If they all refuse to do Yibum, we go back to the oldest and tell them to do Yibum or Chalitza. You have to act. Make your decision and act. So again, the responsibility lays with the older brother. But in the face of Chalitza, we'd rather there be Yibum. Therefore, we'll give the younger brothers a chance to perform Yibum before we allow the oldest brother to perform Chalitza. And that's why we check with everybody for Yibum first, and then we only ask for Chalitza afterwards. Now, that might be for two reasons. One is the reason that we saw from Reish Lakish before, which is that there is no Chalitza b'makom Yibum. It doesn't exist. Chalitza is not really an alternative to Yibum. It's Yibum. If you don't perform Yibum, then you have to deal with Chalitza. But it's not that these are two equal options. That's one way. Or, the other way to look at it is that we give precedence to Yibum, and Chalitza are equal options. But we still will give precedence to Yibum because that accomplishes something. As opposed to Chalitza, which doesn't accomplish anything. We just think that Yibum is a better outcome than Chalitza. Yibum and Chalitza are equal options. I'm saying that they are equal. They're both good options. Why we give precedence to Yibum and Chalitza is because Yibum does what we want, which is that Yikumo Shem Achiv, that it does give some sort of Lo Yimachesh Mo Yisrael. It does give some continuum to the brother that was deceased. So we'll give precedence to that, not because it's a better choice, but just simply because that's what the Torah really wanted, like the Ramban describes. But if you do Chalitza, it would have been an equal option. We just try for Yibum because that gets a little more benefit to us. Right, so that's the two ways to look at that. But Yibum gets precedence, then we go to Chalitza. The oldest brother is held accountable, and Beit Din goes to the oldest brother and forces him to act in the end if nobody else is willing to act. Right, anitana l'shivcha v'nishtachra, olo v'zit kochavim v'nitgariya. So now there are rumors circulating about an individual having a relationship with a Shivcha Kenanit, or about him having a relationship with a non-Jewish woman. Then the Shivcha is freed, or the non-Jewish woman converts. Harizeh lo yichnos. He should not marry these women. Vim kanas, ein motzim yado. But if he does marry her, we're not going to force him out. So let's look at the two sides. Why is it that we don't want you to marry this woman? So there are two reasons. Some of the Rishonim suggest that the reason we don't want you to marry this woman is because then you're reinforcing the rumors. When you marry the woman, it basically validates the rumors that were out there. And then it basically says that this guy was having a relationship with a Shivcha Kenanit, or that he was having a relationship with a non-Jewish woman. Because that what it reinforces, or basically gives a stamp of approval to the rumors. But if he marries, then we're going to say, okay, he did it already. We don't have evidence of the fact that there was some wrongdoing over here. Since we don't have any evidence, we have no reason to kick him out at this point in time. So just on a rumor, we're not going to kick him out. The other possibility, which Rashi seems to suggest over here, the problem is that if you marry this woman, it's going to cast aspersions on her conversion. It's going to say that she only converted to marry this individual, and therefore it's not going to be that it reinforces the rumor, it's going to cast aspersions on the gerut that she underwent, and that's why we don't want to do it. But once he marries her, we can't say, like after the fact, we're not going to say maybe there was a problem, we can't prove anything, it's all a safek, we're not going to force him to divorce her over a safek. Alright, now, the next piece. Hanitan al eshet ish. There are rumors circulating about an eshet ish, an extramarital affair. Vehotziyo mitachad yado. And they took him away. Afu bish kanas yotzi. Even though he married her, he has to take her out. Who this is speaking about is very interesting. Rashi says over here, because midoraita asura nami de boel. The Torah says that if there's an extramarital affair that takes place, a woman has an extramarital affair, she's not only asur the baal, she's asur to her husband, she's also asur the boel, to the one who had the extramarital affair with her. So therefore, she's not allowed to be married to her husband, but she's also not allowed to be married to the boel, to the one who she had the affair with. So for this case, if there's a problem with Eshidish, and v'utziyo mitachat yado, the pashtut here is that they removed him from the baal's hands over here, they forced him to divorce the woman because of this extramarital affair, then this person who went ahead, the boel, the person who she was conducting the affair with, goes ahead and marries her. There, we're going to force him out. Because just like she's a surah to her husband, so too is she a surah to the boel. And there's an isha doraita. Okay, so that's the question here. That's what Gemara is going to deal with. Why over here is it different than the first case? What basis was the divorce on? And then why do we force him out? Like, what type of evidence do we have over here? That's what the Gemara is going to deal with that as well. Okay, now, this Gemara here is very important, controversial, and current event type of Gemara, and so therefore it has major implications. Gemara says, Hagyoret mi'ahavyo. It says over here that the assumption being that even though she did not convert to become a Jew, she only converted to marry this individual, nevertheless, the conversion goes through. That's the assumption. The assumption is here that he was possibly conducting an affair with this woman. This woman converts, and then the guy marries her. So there's a lot of circumstantial evidence that she only converted to marry this individual. Nevertheless, the Mishnah does not question her standing as a Gioret. Because if they did question her standing as a Gioret, then they would force him to divorce her because there would be a problem being married to an Achrit. So the fact that they don't force him out shows you that they accept the fact that her conversion went through. And now we're only dealing with, it doesn't look good. The other Rishonim also note, Tosafot over here notes, if you look over here, Mi'ahavyo, Demashma lo yichnosu, Abal acher shari lichnos lechatchila, that the only person precluded from marrying this woman, lechatchila, is the person who the rumors were circulating about. But any other Jew could go ahead and marry this woman, despite the fact that it looks like she only converted to be in a marriage. So now, Veraminu, is that really true? Echad ish, shenit gayer l'shum isha. Whether a man converted to marry a Jewish woman. Or a non-Jewish woman converted in order to marry a Jewish man. Or they converted to take part of the Shulchan Melachim, means that the Jews were ascendant at the time. Things were going well. So they only converted in order to be a part of the winning team. or they want to be married to people who are in power, like Avdei Shlomo, who have Srara, who have some sort of political power, and we saw before that they caused problems because of that, they produced a lot of Mamzerim. Einan Gerim. That does not work. That type of conversion, it does not work. Divrei Rabbi Nechemia. Sheya Rabbi Nechemia Omer. Echad Gerei Arayot. Whether the conversion is because of the fear of the lions, meaning that there's some sort of compelling reason to convert because they're afraid of some event that's taking place. Echad Gerei Chalomot. Or someone converts because of a dream. If someone came to them in a dream and told them to convert. Case of Gerei Arayot could be literally, that's the story that's told in Sefer Melachim, about in the Shomron, that they converted because the lions were running wild amongst them and killing them, so they converted because they thought that would protect them from the lions. Or, in the time of Mordechai and Esther, it says, V'rabim el armei aretz mityahadim, that many of the people were converting. Why were they converting? Because of the fear of Mordechai and Esther. It wasn't because they really wanted to, it was nafal pachtam, that there was a pachad that was there. V'echad gerei Mordechai v'Esther, which is the next example, einam gerim. They are not considered to be converts, Ad shidgaru bizman hazeh, until they are converted today. Bizman hazeh? Sakadatcha, I mean, only today? All the gerim in the past don't count? So it says, ela ema kib bizman hazeh. Like today, where the Jews are not ascendant, where the Jews are in exile, where things are not going well for them, that's when a ger comes in, because that's evidence of the fact that they're a ger tzedek. The fact that they're not converting for ulterior motives. We have eliminated all the ulterior motives, then they're converting because they truly want to convert. And that's what we're looking for. We want to know what their true motives are. By taking away all of the exogenous variables that could have caused them to convert, then we know they're converting for the right reasons. So he says, that's bizman hazeh. That's when things are like they are today. Hayit marla. Wait, but we had said on this, Amar Rav Yitzchak bar Shmuel bar Marta mishmei durav, halocha kedivrei omer kulam gerim heim. The locha is like in all these cases, that they are gerim. That they are good converts. That's the locha. We pass the locha. They're all good converts no matter what. Whatever the ulterior motives are, they are gerim. Well, if that's the case, that they're all gerim, then why can't he marry this woman? Again, in the case of the Mishnah, where she converted to marry him, you're telling me that, okay, it works. If it works, then why can't he marry this woman already? Say, Mishom de Ravasi. Because of Ravasi, Dama Ravasi, Ravasi quotes a pasuk from Mishlei, Haser mimcha ikshut peh, you should remove or put away from yourself dissembled speech, ulezut svatayim, and perverse lips, harchek mimecha, you should distance from yourself. Now truthfully, the pashtut of pasuk is exactly what Ravasi says, you don't need Ravasi to say it, it's a pasuk in Mishlei. So many suggest that Ravasi used to say this all the time, so it was attributed to him because this was something that he regularly mentioned. That you should make sure to be nikiyim meinei Hashem umeinei Yisrael. You have to avoid rumors circulating about you. You have to act in a way that people don't think bad things about you. So it's over here. It just doesn't look good. You're right. But lechatchila, in terms of geirut, there's no issue here. That in terms of marrying this woman, what is the issue? The issue is that you're reinforcing the rumors that were there before, and a person should do whatever he can to remove bad rumors about himself. So now, Tanu Rabbanan. In mikablim gerim limota Mashiach. We will not accept gerim in the future, in the time of Mashiach. Geyotzeva lo kiblu gerim lo bimei David v'lo bimei Shlomo. Similar to the fact that they did not accept gerim in the time of David and Shlomo. Again, for different reasons. In the time of David, because of the fear of his conquest. In the time of Shlomo, because of the tremendous power and span of the kingdom of Shlomo. I mean, how good things were. Tosafot does ask about certain individuals who converted in the time of Shlomo, including the wife of Shlomo, Bat Paro, who converted at that time. So how do we deal with that? And also the Maaseh Givonim at that time. So over there, he gives different reasons. One of them, I think, is interesting with regards to Bat Paro. The reason that we don't allow people to convert during the time of David and Shlomo is because of Shulchan Melachim. Because things are going so well. She was a malka already. She was a princess. She didn't need the Shulchan Melachim. So therefore, we don't have that fear that she's converting because of Shulchan Melachim. So that's an interesting answer. And then, again, he talks about other individuals that converted. So Amar Rabbi Eliezer, my Kara, what's the Pasuk? Hein gur yagur, efes me'oti, kigar itach, alayich yipol. So here, the Pasuk says, hein gur yagur, when they gather together, efes me'oti, but not by me. Mi gar itach, whoever gathers against you, alayich ipol, shall fall for your sake. So the the brusha here on the pasuk seems to be that hein gur yagur efes me'oti. They will get nothing. Efes means zero. So there won't be anything. There will be no conversions at that point in time. Migaritach alayichipol. Whoever's with you already will stay with you. So mean whoever is already converted stays with you. Anyone who gathers at this point in time, efes, they will be nothing. They will not count towards the gerim. Now, we have to discuss here is there are a number of issues, one of which is, do conversions like this work? And the halacha seems to be, the way that Rav Paskin said, the halacha is that they do work. So I would take one step back, machloket rishonim, with regards to gerei arayot. Gerim that come because of the lions. We have another machloket in Shas, it's in the Mishnayot as well, between the Tanaim, as to whether the shomronim were considered to be gerei arayot or gerei emet. Were they real converts, or they only converted because of the fear of the lions? So here, we have a machlok between Rabbi Nechemiah, and there's another day'ah, whether gerei arayot works or doesn't work. Is this the same machloket? From Rashi, it seems yes. Look at Rashi. Rashi says, gerei arayot, kegon kutim. He says, I'll give you an example, that's the kutim. Rashi parallels the two machlokot and says, just like over here, there's a machloket by gerei arayot, that is the same machloket we find by the kutim. Does it work, or does it not work? So Rashi parallels the machlokot. Tosafot over here and many of the other Rishonim say that they're totally separate. That there, the problem with the Kutim was that after they converted, they were still worshipping their own gods. They were still worshipping Avodah Zarah. Since they're worshipping Avodah Zarah, that's why over there, even if they were Gerayot, and we would accept Gerayot, we don't accept them because there's a question about their sincerity. The one who says Gerayot says that later they gave up the Avodah Zarah and they converted properly, and that's why it was Gerayot. So those Rishonim believe that this has nothing to do with that because those are separate case. The Kutim were a separate issue because of the Avodah Zarah. This is a different case. But this does lead us down to a question of sincerity. Here the Rishonim bring up the issue of sincerity. Now, what does that mean in this context? Why is it that these Gerim that are converting for ulterior motives are considered to be Gerim? So many of the Rishonim stayed over here because there's an Umdana here that we assume they, in the end, they do it for the right reasons. That even though the primary motive is the wrong reason, we assume in the end that they did it because they wanted to do it. And they really wanted to be Jewish in the end. We have evidence of something like that. The people that quoted like the Gemara in Bava Batra. The Gemara in Bava Batra says that if you are forced to sell something at gunpoint, in the end, it's a mekach goes through. Why? Because Gomer Omakne. And then he came to a conclusion that the best thing for him is that he wants to sell it and he sells it. So there is a kinyan that goes through. So the same thing over here. We assume that even though the motive for the conversion was wrong, we assume underlying that was, in the end, that they did the right thing. So that's why by the Gerei Kutim, these Rishonim say that they're not converts, because we have evidence after the fact that it clearly was not their intention. They ended up worshiping Avodah Zarah. So that's, it might be the same thing over here. Tosfot quotes a number of issues, like by Hillel. Those Gerim that said, convert me to be a Kohen Gadol. Convert me, da-da-da-da-da. We have a number of those scenarios in Shas, and they accepted them as Gerim. Why is that? So, Tosfot says, because Hillel assessed the situation and figured out that they were really going to be Gerei Emet, and that if he converted them, they would come around and do the right thing. So that was the assessment. But what happens in situations where you have evidence that the only reason for the conversion is for marriage? Because what happens after they convert? They're not practicing Jews. They don't do anything that has anything semblance of being a practicing Jew. It's clear that they only converted in order to the marriage. In that case, it seems like the conversion should not go through, and it's not a good conversion. Now, there's two stages or two ways to look at this. The question is, after the fact and before the fact. Here, many times, the Rambam seems to say this. The Rambam doesn't learn like the other Rishonim, but just says, once a person is converted, even if it's all the wrong reasons, they still remain in Israel, and they can't, even if they start worshipping Avodah Zarah afterwards, then you can't unwind it because they are Israel. Now, for the Rambam, it might be that in the interim stage, they did practice as a Jew. And that's what confirmed the original Gerut. And then when they go off the path afterwards, that's not a problem. But the Rambam seems to say, once any form of conversion has taken place, after the fact we look at this, you can't just say they're not Israel. That's the Rambam. But according to most of the Rishonim, it seems to be that the Gerut would not go through if these people were not really sincere in the end. And that causes a problem. The Shulchan Aruch posits it's a safek. And that brings up the issue today of people who convert to get married, where it's very clear that they're converting just to get married. And in terms of their practices post the conversion, there's evidence of the fact that they didn't convert for any reason besides being married. Does that work? Is that really a conversion? And so many poskim believe that it's not a good conversion. And those rabbis that are performing these quote-unquote Orthodox conversions are very problematic, because those Orthodox conversions are not really real gerut, because you can't create a gerut that is premised simply on marriage. It has to be premised on acceptance of being a total Jew. Yes, the Gemara here says that they are converts, but that's with the underlying assumption that that reason compels them to get to the point where they really accept Yadut fully. But if we have evidence that that's not the fact, or it's very clear that they have no intention of doing that, how can you claim that this person is really a ger? So there are many poskim who believe that these people convert are not converts. And it's a serious issue, where there are obviously others that disagree, and it seems to be those that disagree probably are in the minority, and many times are less learned in these issues, that they convert them anyway, saying that, oh, the situation would be worse if we don't convert them, and they're relying on the more simple reading of the Gemara here, that even if they convert for the wrong reasons, that that is considered to be a convert and it goes through, despite the fact that many of the Rishonim and Achronim qualify all of this, saying that they need to be full-fledged converts in the end, otherwise it doesn't work. After the fact, again, you have to deal with both issues, both after the fact and before the fact. Before the fact, nobody would recommend converting just for the reason of marriage. But after the fact, if they converted for just marriage, but we see that they're a practicing Jew, that one might validate the original conversion. But if they're not a practicing Jew, then you'd have to have serious reservations about the original conversion, and then you have to really question whether the person that's married now is Jewish, and whether the children that are born out of that are Jewish. All right, now, Anitan al Yeshadish. Amar Rav ube'edim. Rav says our Mishnah must be talking about a case where there were edim to the fact that there was this extramarital affair. Amar Sheshet, Amina, ki naim v'shachiv Rav, Amar l'hai shmatita. Rav must have been dozing off when he said this, because there's no way that he would have said something like this. Titania, because we have a braita that explicitly says otherwise. Hanitan al Yeshadish, rumors are circulating about an extramarital affair. Vehotziu al Yado. And because of that, they forced the husband to divorce the woman. She marries a third party. Not the Baal, not the Boel, she goes and marries a third party. Imkanas lo yotzi. If after she was married to a third party, then the Boel marries her, then we allow it to go through. Now Gemara says, Hechidami, what's the case over there? If we have edim that there really was an extramarital affair over here, kiata acher v'afseke lekala mayhavi. Just because another party stepped in and married her in the interim, why does that change any of the facts on the ground? The facts on the ground, there's a boel and a baal. The baal's a sore, the boel is a sore. Doesn't matter that someone else married in the interim, the boel remains a sore, and we'd have to force him out. Elav delek edim. It must be that there were no witnesses. B'taim adata acher v'afseke lekala. The only reason that we don't force him out is because she married a third party in the interim. So by marrying the third party in the interim, that stops the rumors. And then later on, when she goes back and marries the person that she had the rumors about, that's already a new event. It's a new story. So halav hachi, had it not been for that, mafkinan. Had it not been for the interim party that married her, then we would force her out even without edim. We would force her out from the rumored boel. So amar lecha Rav, who adin dafagab delo ata acher v'afseke lekala. No, that braita would say it even if there wasn't an interim party that married her. Iyuk edim mafkinan. Iyuk edim lo mafkinan. If they're edim, we take her out. If they're no edim, we don't force them out. V'hochi kamar. And this is what that braita means. Dafagab de ata acher v'afseke lekala. Even though there's a third party that married her in between, b'chadchila lo yichnos. Still, he should not marry her in the interim. That's what the chiddush here is. That even when you have a third party in place there, don't go and marry her lechatchila. Meaning that even though there's a third party and the rumors have stopped, the boel should still not marry her in the absence of edim. So even though there are no edim here, and there's a third party that intervened and married in between, still lechatchila, the boel should not marry this woman. If he does, we won't force him out. But lechatchila, he shouldn't marry her. That's the chiddush of the braita, not the fact that there was a third party here and there was no edim here. That's if she doesn't have children from the first husband. If she has children from the first husband, we don't force her to divorce the second. Because if we force her to divorce the second person, what we're doing is reinforcing the rumors that she had an extramarital affair, and that'll cast aspersion on the children from the first marriage. So in that scenario, we're not going to force her out. But if you have edim here that there was an extramarital affair, afilu yishal kama banim teitzei, it doesn't matter. The boel is asur to be with her. We're going to force her out whether or not there are children over here. This is a case where she already married the Boel, and we're going to force her out of the Boel. If we force her out of the Boel, we're going to reinforce the fact that there was an extramarital affair, because that's why the Boel is Asur over here. If we do that, we cast aspersion on the original children, because she was having an extramarital affair. Maybe these children were born out of an extramarital affair. So therefore, we don't do it if it's only rumors. But if they're Edim, for sure we would force them out, because it's an Issur d'oraita for him to live with her. It doesn't matter whether we're casting aspersions or not. So again, that is against Rav's position. Because it's clear here that the first case is talking about when she doesn't have children. But if she has children, lo teitzei. But the first case where it says she doesn't have children, it's talking about a case with no Edim. Because they're talking about Edim, children, no children, doesn't matter. So when it says, Ma'av muki lo matitin ve'esh labanim. Rav establishes our mission in a case where she has children. Ve'esh la Edim. And we have Edim. So Rav says our mission is talking about a case of Edim and Bonim. So in the end, Rav comes around basically to the same conclusion as Rav Sheshet, because he establishes our mission as being a case where she has children and Edim. So in our mission, we force them to divorce because they're Edim. And that's despite the fact that there are children, we force her to divorce. What forced Rav to set up our mission that way? Why don't you just simply send it up like Rav Sheshet? No children and no Edim. And you can come to that same conclusion that he has to divorce her because there's a problem of the extramarital affair over here, and she's Asur the Boel. So there's a time of Ika Edim Mafkinan. Vileka Edim Lo Mafkinan. Lukma, let's set it up in a case, B'shein Labanim, she doesn't have children. Vavgav Deleka Edim, and there are no Edim. Just like the way that Rav Sheshet set it up, which seems to be that Rav would agree with that. So why, if Rav's going to agree with Rav Sheshet in the end, what forced him to set up the Mishnah in such a convoluted manner? It says, Amarava Matnitan Kashite. The problem is, was shown in the Mishnah. My area, the Tani Hotzi Uha. In the Mishnah, it doesn't say that the Baal divorced her. It doesn't say Hotzi Ota, that he divorced her. It says Hotzi Uha, that they forced him to take her out, forced him to divorce her. Right? Litna Hotzia, that she removed him. Ella Hotzi Uha. Hotzi Uha sounds like Bebeitin. Beitin got involved and forced the divorce on the original husband. Ubeitin, Beitin Udamafke. The only reason Beitin would force the original husband to divorce is because they're witnesses here. Vi Baitema. Hani matnaita rabihi. Others suggest that no, the reason that Rav doesn't have to go through all these acrobatics to say that the Mishnah is this way is because those other brayto that we quoted are according to Rabbi. The Tanya Ruchel Yotzei. If a iterant salesman who goes from house to house selling wares, Vishach Hogerit Bitsinar, a husband comes back into the house, and as he's walking in the door, the salesman's walking out, and he comes in and he finds his wife wearing a sinar. A sinar seems to be some sort of undergarment that is worn for tzniut, but it's evidence or circumstantial evidence that there was something going on before he got home. Why is she just wearing this sinar? Why isn't she either fully dressed, or why is she wearing something that only would be available to her husband or seen by her husband? That's evidence of the fact that there must have been something going on beforehand. Amarabi hol mechura davar teitzei. Since it's something that is disgusting, meaning that there's such circumstantial evidence that something must have taken place, he has to issue a divorce, or we force a divorce. Rok the mala min akila. If they, again, the same scenario where the rochel is walking out of the house, the husband walks into the house, someone's walking out of the house. Then he comes into his bedroom and he sees on the canopy above that there's some sort of spittle or something on the canopy above. Amarabi o mukhura davar teitzei. Since it's disgusting, we, again, he should divorce her. What happened here, the assumption is that they had bia while they were in there, and the woman, in her excitement of the bia, somehow spit up, and the spit got up into the kila. Otherwise, why is there spit on top of the kila unless someone's facing towards the canopy? Menalayim hafuchim tachar amita. If their shoes overturned under the bed, amarabi hol mechura davar teitzei. Since it's disgusting, they will go out. What are menalayim hafuchim? So menalayim hafuchim. Lechsei demaninu. Let's see whose shoes they are. I mean that you're suggesting here that these are the shoes of the Rochel. And it's clear that his shoes were taken off in the bedroom. And that's why it's Mechura Devar. Just take a look and see whose shoes are they are. Ela makom menayalayim mahafuchim. It is not that they are there, the shoes still. But where the shoes are placed, that's what is hafuch. Now Rashi brings two. Nikavar makom hafichatam ba'afar. So that under the bed, it looks like somebody had taken off shoes and left them over there. That there was like some sort of mess under the bed. So it was clear, like in their day when you had dirt in the house, there's an imprint or there's something there that makes it look like it. But not only that, it looks like the shoes were upside down, which means it looks like somebody did it in a rush, took off their shoes. That's one. Or Rashi brings another position, which is that he normally put his shoes in one place, and his wife put his shoes in the other place. And now he finds his wife's shoes in his place. Why is that? Because the person who came in put his shoes where the husband normally did, so the wife was forced to put her shoes where her husband puts the shoes. Rashi opts for the first one. He thinks the first one's right, because then it should have said hafuch, which is the place was switched, not hafuchim, which means flipped over, the shoes were flipped over. So now the Gemara concludes, ve'ilchata kavate derav, ve'ilchata kavate derabi. The halacha is like Rav, and the halacha is like Rabbi. And the Gemara, which we'll deal with tomorrow, is kasha ilchata ilchata. Now you have a stira in halacha, because Rav says you only have to be miyotze when there's edim. So that would be that you need evidence. And Rabbi is saying even mechora davar, even when there's a rumor, you have a case of teitze. So how do we reconcile between those two facts? That's what the Gemara will deal with yesterday. It's clear that Rav disagrees with Rabbi. And Rabbi disagrees with Rav. The question is, we who pass like both of them, how do we reconcile between the two piskei halacha? How do we balance between Rabbi and Rav if we're going to pass them like both of them? There's a very interesting Tosafot over here about mechora davar. Amar Rabbi Tenu Teitze, what is Teitze over here? I read it all along, I didn't say what it was, but it seemed from the way I was reading it is that the husband should divorce her. In all these cases, the husband should divorce her. The Tosafot says that's not the case. The Teitze in this Gemara is all from the Rochel. If she marries the Rochel, if she marries the iterant salesman, then Teitze. We force her to divorce, because Mechora Davar. We have circumstantial evidence that there was an affair here. But there is no obligation on the Baal to take out or divorce his wife. Because the Ein Lomar Teitze Min Baal, then Aisha Neserda Bala El Yedei Kinoi V'Stira. O Ad Shiru Derech Menafin. The only way that a Baal and a wife become a Surim is if we have evidence. Evidence is that we have Edim or Kinoi V'Stira, where the Baal warned her and formerly gave her a warning that she cannot be together miyachi with this person, and she goes ahead and does it anyway, then because of Sota, the dinim of Sota, he becomes a suur to her. But those are the only scenarios. Otherwise, just because of a safek or circumstantial evidence, it's not a suur for the Baal to remain, and we will not force the Baal to divorce his wife, even though maybe he should be divorcing his wife, unless we have fact on the ground, unless we have real evidence. So therefore, Tosafot reads all the teitze over here of Rabbi as being that, The third party, if he marries this woman, the husband divorced her willingly. I mean, he decided that he wants her out. She goes in and marries the Rochel. That's Teitze. Rabbi says that they have to get divorced. We don't let them stay together because Mechora Davar. Because it's clear that she was having an extramarital affair with this individual. And therefore, we can push on them. Why is that? That is because there's a, Gemara tells us that it has to do with whether it's prior to Nisuin or after Nisuin. Anything that is a rumor prior to Nisuin, we can enforce. A rumor after Nisuin we can't enforce. So for the Baal, for the husband, the rumor is developed after Nisuin. So therefore, the Nisuin governs, and therefore, you need real evidence to undo the Nisuin. On the other hand, for the Rochel, the evidence or the rumors come up before they ever got married. So since it preceded his marriage to her, there we can enforce it and say you cannot be married, and we'll force them to divorce. So it all has to do with the nature, even though they're the exact same rumor, it has to do with where that rumor is vis-a-vis the marriage. For the husband, it's post the marriage. For the Rochel, that information is prior to the marriage. And therefore, by the husband, we will not force him to divorce. But by the Boel, or the suspected Boel, we will force him to divorce on the rumor based on Rabbi's position. And that's what Tosafot clarifies about our sugyo over here. Okay, we'll stop here. 6 lines down on the top of Chaf Hei Amud Aleph.